Rafael Antonio Lozano. He's a man with a mission, albeit a rather strange one. The 33-year-old computer programmer from Plano, Texas, is on a quest to visit every company-owned Starbucks on the planet. Lozano, who calls himself by the nickname Winter, began his mission in 1997 when there were 1,304 Starbucks worldwide. Winter decided to visit everyone. Today there are over 6,000 in 37 countries. As of October 31st, 2005, so this last October, Winter had visited 4,918 Starbucks in North America, in addition to 213 others around the globe. Despite his impressive pace, Winter is realistic about the nature of his quest, saying, "As long as they keep building Starbucks, I'll never be finished." He's also realistic about the importance of his mission. "Every time I reach a Starbucks, I feel like I've accomplished something," he said, "when actually, I've accomplished nothing." He's right. Talk about a wasted life focused on visiting Starbucks, no matter how much you like coffee. Came across a quote from an anonymous New Tribes missionary who warned us all by saying, "Our greatest fear should not be of failure, but of succeeding in something that doesn't really matter." Ambition. Ambition can be frivolous and wasted, like trying to visit every Starbucks on the planet. Ambition can be a powerful force for good and for God, like William Carey and his desire to reach India for Christ. But ambition can also be horribly destructive, like Abimelech in Judges chapter 9. Abimelech was the illegitimate son of Gideon through his concubine who lived in the city of Shechem, which lay between Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim in the central plateau of Israel. His name means, "My father is king." And even though Gideon refused to be the king of Israel, his son inherited a driving passion for the power his father declined. Our story begins in chapter 8 with the nation at peace and living in prosperity. People who forget God get leaders who reject God. Somehow God has a way of giving us as a nation what we want. And therein lies a tremendous warning. Look at chapter 8, verses 33 to 35. "Then it came about as soon as Gideon was dead that the sons of Israel again played the harlot with the Baals and made Baal-berith their god. Thus the sons of Israel did not remember the Lord their God, who had delivered them from the hands of all their enemies on every side. Nor did they show kindness to the household of Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, in accord with all the good that he had done to Israel." The nation has rested for 40 years under the leadership of Gideon. That's back in verse 28. That is the last time in the book of Judges that the nation will be at rest. The end of chapter 8. From now on, the descending spiral never ends until they reach the point of horrible immorality and total anarchy at the end of the book of Judges. We are starting that downward slide as we hit the story of Abimelech. Now, if we're going to understand Abimelech, we have to understand the worship of Baal in the town of Shechem. Shechem was a town that was, according to the biblical record, never conquered by the Israelites. Archaeologists have uncovered the ruins of a large temple complex devoted to the Canaanite god Baal-berith in the town of Shechem, where Abimelech was from, the Baal that is mentioned here. Most scholars believe that Shechem remained predominantly a Canaanite town, and that, in fact, the concubine who was Abimelech's mother may well have been Canaanite herself, for this was a Canaanite village. The name Baal-berith means Lord of the Covenant or Master of the Contract. This god was worshipped as the one who controlled agreements between people on earth. Shechem was a village that sat directly on a very important crossroads in the nation. One of the major trade routes running north and south intersected with a major trade route running east and west at the village of Shechem. As such, Shechem was the seat of many commercial contracts between businessmen in the region. This was a major commercial center in central Israel. Notice that the people had forgotten the principles of Gideon. They did not remember God who had done all that he had done for them through Gideon, and they had turned to idolatry in the service of materialism, commercialism. They worshipped at the god of gold, the idol of prosperity. And the nation was prosperous because God had blessed them in these 40 years of peace. And now they worshipped at the god of materialism. And therein is a tremendous warning for America. For if anything, our country worships the god of gold. The people turned away from God as they pursued money, the trappings of success, and the result they got was Abimelech. A nation gets what it wants in leadership. We can say whatever we want to say, but God knows the hearts. People who forget God get leaders who reject God. That has been God's pattern. And once a nation, any nation, is caught in the grip of godless leaders, it is hard to get out of that downward spiral for a nation. Ravi Zacharias tells about his experiences a few years ago in Russia. He was meeting with seven Russian generals at the Center for Geopolitical Strategy in Moscow. He and his wife entered the building. He could not help but be impressed by the massive statues and pictures of great military leaders from Russia's past, like Peter the Great and Mikhail Kutuzov, who had led the Russian forces against Napoleon. The generals talked for several hours with Zacharias and his wife. At one point in the meeting, one of the generals summarized their feelings in a rather icy tone when he said, "We know what war can do, and we have a great fear of it." As the generals lined up to say goodbye, they each took Rabbi Zacharias' hand and kissed it gently. Finally, the chief of staff said to Rabbi Zacharias, "Mr. Zacharias, I believe that what you have said about our need for God is true. But after 70 years of believing a lie, it is hard to change." Here's a nation and a people and a culture with a rich history, a great heritage, who spawned a leader like Joseph Stalin. How can that be? People who forget God get leaders who reject God. And it's very, very hard to change once you've gone down that godless path very far as a culture. America should be warned, for God is not mocked. We will get what we want. And if we want godlessness in the pursuit of wealth and power in this world, we will get godless leaders. But the end will be destruction, not real success. Ambition, you see, without character leads to success without conscience. Verses 1 through 3 of chapter 9. And Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal, went to Shechem to his mother's relatives and spoke to them, to the whole clan of the household of his mother's father, saying, "Speak now in the hearing of all the leaders of Shechem. Which is better for you, that 70 men, all the sons of Jerubbaal," that's Gideon, "rule over you, or that one man rule over you? And remember that I am your bone and your flesh." And his mother's relatives spoke all these words on his behalf in the hearing of all the leaders of Shechem. And they were inclined to follow Abimelech, for they said, "He is our relative." Now Abimelech could be a case study for modern psychologists. He's a man driven by ambition. He wants to be king. He has one claim to fame. He's the son of the great Gideon. But he is not looked on with respect. He's not welcomed in Gideon's home, for he is the illegitimate son of Gideon by a woman in the town of Shechem, probably a Canaanite woman. Now we can read between the lines. Gideon's other sons did not treat him with the respect he felt he deserved. Perhaps Gideon, his father, rejected him as well. Abimelech is a man spurned, whose rejection fuels his lust for power. He will prove his own greatness to those who doubt his abilities. So he goes back to Shechem, to his mother's family. And he uses his persuasive powers to get a hearing with the leaders of the city. Now Abimelech was probably a strong, handsome, charismatic person who was able to manipulate others and win his way in life. He was probably very talented and effective, for these kinds of people come along in every generation and in many situations. He argues that he is one of them, so they should back his quest for power. The leaders of Shechem agree with him. As one writer put it, blood is thicker than brains. Verse 4. And they gave him 70 pieces of silver from the house of Baal-berith, from the temple of Baal-berith, with which Abimelech hired worthless and reckless fellows. Now, isn't that a great description? And they followed him. Then he went to his father's house at Ophrah, and he killed his brothers, the sons of Jerubbaal, Gideon, 70 men on one stone. But Jotham, the youngest son of Jerubbaal, was left, for he hid himself. So he hires a bunch of thugs, captures the 70 sons of Gideon. He executes them on a stone. Probably it was one of the stones that was used for the slaughter of cattle or sheep. They're all executed on this stone. He's ruthless in his quest for power. He will do whatever he has to do to win. Men like Abimelech are driven by an insatiable thirst for power, respect, control. They are proud men who hate the rejection they have experienced over the years. They're determined to do whatever they have to do to get back at those who rejected them. Rejection by family and friends and peers is a powerful motive for a twisted ambition. The problem is that men with that kind of ambition are black holes, they're sucking everyone they meet into their destructive lives. They are never content to just do well at something. In fact, they pull all of those who enter into relationships with them into the black hole that leads to destroyed lives. Adolf Hitler was such a man. Came to power in post-war Germany. The Germans wanted desperately to recover from World War I. They wanted to become a power again. They wanted material prosperity, and Hitler promised it all. William Shire recounted his experiences listening to Hitler speak before the war in Germany. Here was a man, too, who had been spurned by many. And as William Shire recounted these stories after the war, he said, "I would listen to the man speak many, many times during those years, particularly at Nuremberg in 1934 when he spoke, long before the war started. And I would listen to the man speak and I would think to myself, what utter rubbish, what brazen lies. But the people loved Hitler. They ate it up. They would believe anything he said. he would establish an uncanny rapport with his audience until he literally held them spellbound. He would say anything and they would believe him. Shirer wrote after the war. The same is true on a lesser scale with all destructively ambitious people. They have an uncanny knack for manipulating others to follow them, for tapping something inside of others that grabs and holds them under their power. Verse 6, "And all the men of Shechem and all Beth Millo assembled together, and they went and made Abimelech king by the oak of the pillar, which was in Shechem." Abimelech achieves his goal. The men of Shechem gather to crown him king by the oak that stood next to the pillar in Shechem. Many scholars believe that this slide is a picture of the ancient stone erected by Joshua many years earlier, and that a great oak tree stood here at one time. It was a holy place for all of Israel, because Joshua, just before he died, gathered the people of Israel at Shechem. And he made a covenant, a contract with the people there. And he wrote the words of that covenant in the book of the law. And he placed it under the stone, under the oak, or next to the oak tree, next to the tabernacle. Joshua chapter 24, verse 26. And the people of Shechem now, what have they done? They have taken this holy spot where God made an agreement with the people, and it was reinforced by Joshua after all that God had done for them. And they took this holy place, this place of a covenant with God, a contract with God, and they made a contract with Baal-berith, the lord of the contracts, the lord of gold and materialism. They took this holy place and they profaned it. And they said, "We, in the name of Baal-berith, the master of contracts, make an agreement with you, Abimelech, to be our king." They chose to follow this destructively ambitious and unscrupulously evil man to their own doom, as we will see next Sunday. Sometimes the most talented people are the most destructive. The most proud people, the most capable people, are filled with lies and have an uncanny ability to manipulate others for a while to believe them. Few people have had as many natural endowments or achievements as Edwin Hubble, the astronomer for whom the Hubble Space Telescope was named. Hubble was a gifted athlete. As writer Bill Bryson recounts at a single high school track meet in 1906, he won the pole vault, the shot put, the discus, the hammer throw, standing high jump, running high jump, and he was on the winning mile relay team. He also set state records in the state of Illinois. On top of his athletic gifts, Hubble was extremely good looking. They called him an Adonis in the newspapers. If that weren't enough, Hubble was intellectually gifted above all his peers. He studied physics and astronomy at the elite University of Chicago. He was selected to be one of the first Rhodes Scholars at Oxford. When Hubble began his career as an astronomer at Mount Wilson Observatory in California in 1919, only one galaxy was known, the Milky Way galaxy. But Hubble showed in a landmark paper in 1924 that the universe contained many galaxies. Then Hubble proved that the universe was expanding, something that had not been proven before. Either one of those achievements would have guaranteed Hubble a place in history, but for Hubble it was not enough. Hubble claimed he spent most of his late 20s and early 30s as a prestigious lawyer in Kentucky. Actually, he spent those years as a high school teacher in Indiana. Hubble boasted that in World War I he had bravely led, quote, frightened men to safety across the battlefields of France. The truth was he arrived in France only 1 month before the armistice and probably never even heard a shot fired. Hubble told people how he had daringly rescued drowning swimmers, but that story never happened. Hubble bragged about how he had taken on an exhibition bout with a world-class boxer and surprised the champion with an amazing knockdown punch, That also was too good to be true. Sometimes the most gifted people are the greatest liars and con artists, just like Abimelech. That leads us to the third principle, so important. Who a leader is determines what a leader does. Who you are inside, not who you can con, is what really matters. Look at verse 7. Now, when they told Jotham, he went and stood on the top of Mount Gerizim and lifted his voice and called out. Thus he said to them, "Listen to me, O men of Shechem, that God may listen to you." There was a fly in Abimelech's grand coronation. The scene is almost humorous. One son of Gideon had escaped. His name was Jotham, and he stood on top of Mount Gerizim looking down at the gathering in Shechem as they coronated Abimelech king. At the right moment, he raised his voice so that the people could hear him 800 feet below in the village center. Looking down, he said, "In the name of God," and he told them a story. He told them a story about the trees and how they wanted a king. And the great cedars and all of these great trees went out looking for a king. And first they came to the olive tree. And they said to the olive tree, "Will you, olive tree, be our king, the king of the trees?" And the olive tree said, "No, I have important work to do." And so they came to the fig tree and they said, "Fig tree, will you be our king?" And the fig tree said, "No." And so they came to the vine and they said to the vine, "Vine, will you be our king?" And the vine said, "No, I will not be the king of the trees." And then they came to the bramble bush and they said to the bramble bush, "Will you be our king?" In verse 15, the bramble said to the trees, "If in truth you are anointing me as king over you, come and take refuge in my shade. But if not, may fire come out from the bramble and consume the cedars of Lebanon." Now the whole offer is pure con. What kind of shade can a bramble bush give to cedars? It can't. A bramble bush has no shade to offer the other trees. The bramble bush is nothing more than pucker brush. You know what pucker brush is, don't you? I actually think it's a Maine colloquialism. I don't think it's used elsewhere. At least I've never heard it in other parts of the country. But I sure know what pucker brush is, and I'll bet most of you know what pucker brush is. It never grows very high, but it's thick and hard to get to, and it grows around all the swamps and the swales in the backcountry of Maine. We know what pucker brush is. My father-in-law was a real big deer hunter, and he set to work to teach me to hunt deer years ago. And, you know, every time we went out deer hunting, you know where we ended up? In the pucker brush. Every single time. Because he said the deer are in the pucker brush. So, and I'll tell you, pucker brush is no fun. It is so thick and hard to get through. But that's where we went every single time, to the pucker brush. So I became quite used to pucker brush. Well, the only thing that bramble bushes or pucker brush are good for is when they're dried out, they burn real fast and hot. That's what pucker brush can do. The rest of it, it has really no value. But a pucker brush fire can soon destroy a whole forest of great trees. The great cedars of Lebanon can be burned up by a fire that starts in the pucker brush. Jotham's point is clear. Who a leader is determines what a leader does. You people wanted a king. And you've taken Abimelech to be your king. Abimelech is nothing but pucker brush. And when pucker brush is your king, you'll be consumed by fire. Pucker brush is pucker brush. It is what it is. It'll never be anything different. Pucker brush may try to con you into thinking it's a great cedar, but in the end it'll act like pucker brush because that's what pucker brush does. The great jazz saxophonist Charlie Parker during the first half of the 1900s used to say, in terms of playing the saxophone, "If you don't live it, it won't come out of your horn." Well, that's good advice. If it isn't you, it isn't going to happen. Character is who you are when no one else is looking. character is the real you underneath all that you can put out for everyone else. You are who you are. And that is what determines in the end what you really do. That is a message so necessary for our country. Character is the single biggest issue in any presidential election. Because if you're puckerbrush, then you'll be a puckerbrush president or any other leader. You are who you are, and that determines what you do. Peter Molyneux is the creator of several popular video games today. His genre is what is known as God games, where the player influences a simulated world. It's a popular genre today. His newest product is a game called Fable. Players create a character and lead that character from childhood to adulthood through the game. The point is to become a hero by saving the land of Albion in the game of Fable. Such an adventure is familiar fare in these kinds of games, but Mr. Molyneux directed an 80-member development team to emphasize not what players do, but how they do it in the course of the game, the kind of character their choices produce, and how the world reacts to that character. So rather than starting the game with a predetermined character type, the character is formed by all the choices that the player makes as that character grows from childhood to adulthood. And then that becomes their character that it attempts to win the victory in Albion. Well, there's a great lesson on life there, isn't there? Isn't that how life works? We become what we choose, and if we become puckerbrush, we'll end up acting like puckerbrush. Who a leader is determines what a leader does in our homes, in our jobs, in our churches, in our countries. Fourth principle, dishonest leaders become destructive achievers. Jotham continues his speech. He points out that time will tell whether Abimelech is a puckerbrush leader or not. And that's very true. That's wise. For often we cannot tell, can we, when we first meet someone, especially if they're talented and gifted and good at what they do. The choice, he says, that you make today, he says to the people of Shechem, will be revealed in what happens tomorrow. Then we'll find out what you've really done. If, he says, they have dealt honorably with Gideon and his household, well, obviously they have not, we already know that from the story, then they will rejoice in their new king and things will go well with them. But if they have committed horrible wrongs, then the puckerbrush king will be shown to be what he is, a con artist. What's worse, he tells them, they will be consumed by the fire that rages out of control in this puckerbrush king, because that's what puckerbrush does. And next Sunday, as we study the legacy of violence that comes out of Abimelech, we will find that it consumes everyone that is associated with him. Then Jotham escapes from Mount Gerizim and he lives out his years in obscurity. A number of years ago, when I was doing research for my doctoral project, I ran across a study that was done in the business world a number of years ago. It was a study of what the authors called destructive achievers in the business world. Destructive achievers. Apparently, there's a long history of power-hungry, ambitious men and women who rise to leadership positions in the corporate world. But they exhibit certain characteristics that eventually destroy not just themselves, but the entire company. They are usually very talented, very driven people who cut corners, live on the edge, take the risks, until they destroy the company itself. The whole argument from this study was that destructive power achievers in a company look very, very good, seem to accomplish a lot, but end up destroying the very company that they're allowed to rise to power in. Well, Enron and WorldCom in recent years are great examples of destructive achievers in the corporate world, who not only bring themselves down, but everyone else who's associated with them. Okay, we see that in the world. But Jotham is really an instructor to the church, God's people. For we have to be careful, because there will always be talented but dishonest people who rise to leadership in our churches too. We'd best beware. It is not just out there where these kinds of destructive people rise. It is often in the church itself. There have been pastors, there have been religious leaders who achieve large followings only to be nothing but pucker brush in the end and bring down the ministry or the church or whatever they're associated with as time goes on. They destroy all who are connected with them, damaging so many lives in the process. As people get caught up in their dishonest and destructive life patterns. So we have to be very, very careful at Galilee Baptist Church who we place in leadership. If we want to serve the Lord effectively, we need honest, godly, character, good character people to lead this ministry or any ministry in a way that honors God. We sang it before we started the message. In your church, Lord, be glorified. It's His church. It's not any of ours. It's not our agendas. It's not for our aggrandizement. It's not for our achievement. It's for Him. Watch out for destructive, dishonest leaders. This little set of slides is labeled bad parenting. I like that. There's a great message there, isn't there? Of course, parenting is the first place we exhibit leadership, the home, the family. And pucker brush leadership in the home leads to some very dangerous situations for those who are under that leadership. But we can apply, surely, this principle to the church as well. Abimelechs are alive and well in the church too, and any who get caught up with them will end up being destroyed when they fall. And we can apply it to our nation, surely. If Abimelechs come to lead the nation of America, the sewer's probably where we're headed. Abimelech is a warning to all of us. Worthless leaders consume foolish followers. Watch out. An episode of the public radio program This American Life tells a story of Nauru, a tiny isolated Pacific island east of New Guinea and 1,200 miles from any sizable landmass. Around the year 1900, two scientists from the Pacific Islands Company began to study what they believed to be a piece of fossilized or petrified wood picked up on Nauru. But instead of fossilized rock, they uncovered the richest phosphate ore ever identified to that time, a discovery so valuable it plunged the little island of Nauru violently into the industrialized era. During the years that followed, the country was colonized by a succession of European and Asian nations in pursuit of financial gain who turned the island into a strip mine. Nauru achieved independence in 1968. But rather than taking responsibility for their resources, their country, their land, the Nauruan government continued the mining practices that had by then brutalized the island. By the early 1980s, Nauru boasted, in the 1980s, the world's highest per capita income. So everyone, this was the wealthiest island in the world, per capita. But its prosperity didn't last. Midway through the 1990s, Nauru's wealth was gone, embezzled by corrupt financial managers, gambled away on risky investments, squandered on extravagant luxuries, for they lived well. With the money gone, the Nauruans can now see the effects of their short-sighted decisions. More than 70% of the island is a mined-out ruin, unable to offer the infrastructure and natural resources to support life. Nauru must now look for a new piece of land on which to relocate its entire population. That's where leadership, bad leadership, takes you. When you're on Nauru, says reporter Jack Hitt, there's a palpable sense of shame at what they've done. The Nauruans literally sold off their homeland for a pot of wealth, which is now lost. It's gone. Same is true for our countries. What are we pursuing? The same is true for our churches. God protect us from leadership that would lead us down that path. Same is true of our families. The God of prosperity breeds destruction. When Puckerbrush is our king, destruction is our end. Father, protect our country. We know that the influences at work in our nation, despite its heritage, despite our background, all that you have blessed us with, and our peace and our material prosperity today, in many ways, our freedom, many ways unrivaled in this world. But it's so easy for our nation to begin to plunge down that path. And we understand that when that goes that way, you may well turn us over to godless leaders. For you give us what we really want. Lord, I pray for our country. I pray for President Bush, for Congress, for our state and local leaders. They face many decisions. And I pray that a moral and righteous character would guide those decisions. And I pray for us as citizens that we would stand true and influence our leadership so that they seek righteousness and morality and truth, life. Protect us from the end that pursues only power and wealth and self-interest and pleasure. For that is the path, Lord, that leads away from you and leads to the Lord of the contract of this world, not you. And I pray for our churches, Lord. Protect us from the kind of leadership that would destroy in its dishonesty, that would damage in its insincerity, and would fail in its untruthfulness, I pray. In Jesus' name, amen.